T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Zero, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Here's a background story for the interview for today that we did with Riz Virk. Give you all the background on this. Here's how it happened. Victoria at Contact and Desert discovered that I had a podcast, and she said, here's the list of the speakers at Contact in the Desert. Whatever ones you want to interview will help set up the interview. And I went, wow. So you got all these high-level speakers, and so I took 12 of them. One of them was Rizwan Virk, who we interviewed today. And he was described as a entrepreneur, video game guy who had written a book on the simulated universe. Are we in a video game? So I'm interested in that whole idea of consciousness and stuff like that. So we set up the interview, and Sinead, my assistant, started to set up the interview. And then what happened was Riz agreed to the interview, and I always feel very uncomfortable in interviews, and because Sinead is very busy, sometimes she can't do interviews during the week. I didn't really want to be up against Riz one-on-one, because I started to listen to some of his interviews that he had done. I realized this guy was like a heavy hitter. I mean, MIT degree, Stanford degree, sold a bunch of video game companies, sort of got the idea we were interviewing the Pope here. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to bring in my AI expert, Chase. And so I said to Chase, Riz has agreed to this interview, and Riz had agreed to 4 o'clock Pacific time on Friday. So I said to Chase, here, you want to come in and help me and ask questions of this guy? So he said, no, I can't do it. And then I thought, okay, so I'll, can you do it 2 o'clock in the afternoon, central time? And, then he said, no, I got to pick up my kid from school. And I had put a link in, the Zoom link. I had set up the Zoom link. Sinead Wellahan and I share an account. So I set it up, and it didn't look like I was waiting for something to fall out of the sky, some miracle that would get Chase involved in this thing. It was at that point that Sinead contacted me. She said, are you cutting me out of this interview? And it was like, you know, you're caught, you know, fooling around on your wife or something. It was that kind of thing. I'm going, like, no, here's what happened, you know. And I said, you're invited to any interview you want. And the reason that the link is there, but it hasn't been sent out yet. You got to understand. I was trying to get Chase involved in the whole thing. And I said, you can come to the interview. And then I realized that she was very much into this, the Matrix and all this kind of stuff. And so anyway, I said to her, okay, send Riz the link. And we're going to go at 4 o'clock. Chase, it's not going to work out. So then I'm talking to editing the final edits on my book on the Canadian government UFO stuff with my assistant Desta. And that was yesterday. So then I said, oh, we're interviewing this heavy hitter guy with you know, the simulated universe and, you know, video game companies and just big time expert. And plus he also links in the spiritual aspect. So the Eastern mysticism and paranormal and stuff like that. So, I mean, this guy understands what's going on. And then she said, oh, really? Can I come to the interview? Can I come? Like, usually she's, you know, she'll come to tape, but she really doesn't want to be involved. And then I realized she was a big Campbell theory of everything fan, and she's read everything on this. And so it was starting to be this sort of thing that we could have sold tickets to this interview. In fact, Sinead had Jen, her friend, was there, and she was sitting in the background watching this interview. So this was like a major interview. And it was one of these interviews, and this is why I'm doing this long intro. This is one of these interviews where it was a come to Jesus moment. It was, where do I send the check? Just unbelievable what happened. So that's the setup, what's going to happen. So I've got these two, and I call them my two avatars. So I actually do the intro. Usually I let Sinead, if she wants to do the intro, said, no, I'm going to control this thing. This is a major guy. I don't want to screw this thing up. I don't want to lose the interview. I'm doing the intro. So I've got this intro, and I describe sort of like a joke. My two avatars are going to join me on stage. So my expression is always, you are not the actor on the stage. You are playing an actor on a stage. Big difference. Almost like this recent thing that Riz actually refers to in his interview, is this thing about the monkey with where they've got this monkey, you know, where they've got the chip in his head, and he's actually the controller is disconnected, and the monkey's actually playing Pong with this chip in his head. And the idea, of course, is that the brain, where we're getting to this point where we've got the brain, is that we got control of the brain, and the brain is playing this ping pong, this Pong game. And it's like, no, you dumb idiot, the monkey's playing the game. It's like, he, just like us, is not an actor on the stage. He's playing an actor, and that the monkey is actually the one playing the Pong game. Now, where the monkey is, whether he's, you know, wherever, but he's definitely not the brain. He's the monkey that's telling the brain. He's the eye that tells the brain how to play the Pong game. So anyway, we got this thing all set up, and I was going to do this bottom line question on consciousness. And so I've always maintained that neurosurgeons and neurologists will always say, no, consciousness creates, matter creates consciousness. And in 2017, I had this noetic download thing with 24 things, and I've talked about it numerous times. And the main one was, is the world made out of little nuts and bolts? If it is, that's one world with certain rules and regulations. But if it's made out of consciousness, that's a completely different world, and all the rules change. And so there's this question that I was going to ask Riz about the primacy of consciousness. And with the video game thing, we're getting into the idea that we have this video game thing, and that we can control this, and we're nothing more than a video game, and this sort of thing. And so the question I wanted to ask was this idea that snow falls in Texas, takes out the power, and if you believe the QAnon thing, it was actually Bill Gates, the big computer guy, who had synthetic snow that fell on Texas and knocked out the power. Is there a video game if the power gets knocked out? And the answer is no. The whole game completely shuts down. And so I was going to ask him this question about the primacy, and the idea is that if you take 14 billion computers and you wire them all together, and you can even turn them on, nothing will happen until there's a consciousness sitting in front of the computer. You need the consciousness to be the players, to play the game. You need the consciousness to put the material on the internet. You need the consciousness to do the software, that nothing will happen without the consciousness. You still need the consciousness. So here comes the story. So it's all set up. Riz comes on. Sinead comes on first. Then Riz comes on. We're chatting, and I'm looking, and Desta hasn't come on. So I'm saying to myself, did I send her the link? Like, what's going on? Why isn't she so excited? And I knew she really wanted to watch this interview. She wanted to be involved and maybe even ask questions. And so then it was 6:05. I said, okay, we're doing it. Let's go. So we start the interview. We go through the whole interview, and it was a good interview. It was about an hour long. And we shut down, and then I'm off to do a very important project I'm working on. But I spent like 2 minutes, and I, for some reason, I just saw the email. And here's Desta's email. She says, my power's out. I can't. I'm waiting. Hopefully I come on before 6 o'clock. I'll be on. Just stay there and hopefully I can get on. And if I come in late, if the power comes on, I'll come in late. I'll come in the background. I won't say anything, but I'm gonna come in. And she's all desperate that she's waiting for the power. And this is the whole point. So she's my avatar. I have the two avatars that are going to join me for the interview, and the one avatar doesn't show up because the power's down. And it's the whole principle that when the power goes off, we always want this thing with the one big giant miracle that we can create consciousness. We can create, this world where matter creates consciousness. But you always require all these, what Terence McKenna called the giant miracle. I need the computers. I need the software. I need all the power. I need, all this kind of stuff and the players. And then I'll explain it as a random event. Well, no, it's all going to fall apart because you basically don't have the consciousness. You need the consciousness to run the whole thing. You can have all the computers in the world you want. You can have all the software in the world you want. You can have all that stuff, but not until there's a player, someone playing the game on the end of the joystick thing, that anything will happen. So here we have this situation where it's exactly the analogy that I was using, was if the power goes down, all this virtual stuff basically ends. But if you have the near-death experience situation where when the brain power goes off, when the brain flatlines, the video game continues. And neurologists and neurosurgeons and neuroscientists will say, no, that's not true. The brain is still somehow, there's a deep action, or makes all sorts of excuses that for some reason that thing is still on. And that's how the person can determine. Now, the biggest story of the whole thing was, and this is one of these things where the analogy comes up where, it's like you got to have like less intelligence than room temperature to not understand the fact that when you are in a operation situation where your eyes are taped shut, you cannot see what's going on. You may be able to hear what's going on in the operating room and hear what people are talking about, but to actually see, you can't. Your eyes are taped shut. And I think it's one of the big near-death researcher guys, the reason that he started was because the one woman said, I saw you talking to my friend in the other room during this thing, and he was thinking there's no way you could do it. And then she actually described to him the fact that he had food on his tie, and he knew that he had been eating spaghetti and that he had something slipped, and the spaghetti had gotten on his tie, and this woman had picked off the fact that it's food on his tie. And so this is the whole thing. When the video game goes down in the real world, everything shuts down. But when the brain goes flatline, when the power is lost to the brain in a near-death experience, the video game continues. And people will say, no, Moses opened the Red Sea. That's the way it is. Just shut up and calculate. And if you want to believe that that there's some magical thing where the brain is picking up material during a near-death experience that helps you sleep at night, go for it. Have fun. Now on to the interview with Riz. Fascinating interview on the whole concept that the universe may be built sort of like on a giant video game.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
wait, Grant, are you introducing or am I? Sorry.
I'm introducing.
Okay.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is Grant Cameron, and I have a super special guest. I'm actually kind of nervous to do the guest tonight. My guest is Riz Virk, who is going to be a speaker at Contact in the Desert. I'm also speaking at Contact in the Desert. I'll be speaking on contact modalities, and my workshop will be on portals and the latest on what the government may have in way of portals. I was lucky enough, Victoria, who runs Contact in the Desert, said to me that because I had a podcast, I could interview anybody I wanted from the speakers. This is one of the ones I chose. Before I get to Riz, I'd like to sort of introduce my avatar that is helping me out today on stage here. She's joined me on tonight's stage play, and that's Annie Hanley. And how you doing, Annie?
Well, Sinead Willihan, otherwise known as Anya Hanley, but let's go with Sinead Willihan tonight.
Oh, I'm you're on Sinead well. Tonight.
Okay. Doing very well. Thank you, Grant. And as always, it's great to be here. And I'm very much looking forward to learning from Riz.
Yeah, because we're going to do simulation. Are we living in a simulation? And we've discussed this probably quite a few times. And so you're going to be Sinead tonight, and it's the old idea. You are not the actor on the stage. You are just playing an actor on a stage. Big difference. So my guest today is Riz, and he is giving his presentation at the Contact in the Desert. His book is called The Simulation Hypothesis, an MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics all agree that we are in a video game. So Riz is a successful entrepreneur, MIT computer trained scientist, video game designer, best-selling author, and independent film producer. This I didn't know. Riz has produced many indie films and once had more than 70 million views, which is unbelievable. His lecture at Contact in the Desert, and the Contact in the Desert, if you've never been there on the ground, it is basically the Super Bowl of weird paranormal stuff. It is like, it's a 3 or 4 star hotel, and you just go like, you just cannot believe how many people are there. There's multiple events going on at the same time. It is unbelievable. So Riz is going to be speaking there. His lecture is going to be on the simulation hypotheses, living in the matrix and unexplained phenomena. And then he's going to be on two panels, which I am definitely going to tune into. The one panel is spirituality, consciousness, new human panel. And the other panel that he's going to be on is the new description of reality panel. And that's basically a lot of the podcast that we're doing is consciousness and it's the nature of reality. And so I'm very honored to have Riz join us tonight. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, I listened to a lot of your interviews and was amazed at the stuff you brought up. Can we go maybe through your background to describe how you got into this little rabbit hole that we're all in here?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I studied computer science many years ago and was working in enterprise software, which has nothing to do with any of this stuff. But about a decade ago, I moved to Silicon Valley and started working in the video game industry and was on the founding team of a couple successful video game companies, including one. We had a game called Tap Fish that was downloaded over 30 million times. And we ended up selling that to a big Japanese company. And, you know, as I learned about how we made video games, I had an interest in consciousness, you know, all along and in meditation. And it was after that, I had invested in a virtual reality company. And I went in their office and I was playing this virtual reality ping pong game that they were building. And so I had the VR headset on and I had the controller in my hand. And it looked to me like there was a real ping pong table in front of me. And there was even an opponent on the other side. And as I played the game, it was so realistic that I forgot that it was all virtual. So much so that at the end of the game, I put the paddle down on the table and tried to lean against the table. And of course, the controller fell to the floor and I almost fell over. And that's when I realized, oh my God, our technology is getting to the point where we will be able to not be able to distinguish between what is real and what is virtual. And so I started to think about how the technology would evolve And I lay out 10 stages of technology development in my book for getting to what I call the simulation point, which is the point at which we can create something like the Matrix, which, as you'll remember from the movie, you know, Neo, Keanu Reeves' character, he had been living his entire life in the Matrix and could not distinguish that that wasn't reality. So that's really what got me started, was looking at it from a technology point of view. But then, of course, I got into the more philosophical aspects of it. And as I started to look into the quantum physics side of it, I realized that being in a simulation was more consistent with some of the weird findings of quantum physics than any other explanation we have at the moment. And also that maybe all the religions have been telling us this all along, that what we see around us is not the real world. And so I ended up writing the book to really pull together these different threads of simulation and reality.
Now, I spent 37 years at a university, not teaching, but I did deal with academics all the time, starting when I was very young as a bartender. So I got to talk to them and have them sort of challenge me. What was the reaction? Like, yours is not as far out as like sort of ghosts, UFOs, paranormal stuff. But what was the reaction? Because you came from MIT and Stanford. What was the reaction from the academia in terms of the simulation, and how long has the simulation theory been around? Is there an opening in the academic community to weird ideas and weird things that we might be talking about now?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is an opening in terms of simulation theory, at least. You know, one of the aspects of simulation theory that I really like is it provides a bridge between the mystical, paranormal, and the scientific, because it provides a technological explanation for things. Now, it was, I think, in 2003 that a professor at Oxford named Nick Bostrom released a paper called "Are You Living in a Computer Simulation?" And, you know, he went through the odds of whether we could be in a simulation or not. And, you know, his argument basically said that if there was any civilization in the galaxy or the universe that got to what I call the simulation point, then they wouldn't create just one simulation. They would create lots of simulations. I mean, literally, all it takes is booting up another process on a server, right? So you could literally have billions of simulations with trillions of beings. And so he came up with a statistical argument that said that if there are way more simulated beings than physical beings, you as a being and me as a being are more likely to be a simulated being, just using simple probability. And so that paper actually opened up this topic in academia. I think before that, it was considered science fiction, right? The Matrix came out in 99. But because of that paper, you know, at least within the philosophical world, within academia, they were willing to talk about it. And then as our technology improved and our rendering of video games, you know, computer scientists started to talk about it. And then, you know, Elon Musk famously said in 2016, that, you know, 40 years ago, all we had was Pong, which, if you remember, was the old Atari game, arcade game that was just two squares and a dot that went back and forth, right? So that, in a way, that was the predecessor to the virtual reality ping pong game that I was playing, you know, 40, 50 years later. In fact, I think it was 2016 when I was playing the game. So it's the same year that Musk said this. And so he said, if you assume any rate of improvement at all, given where video games are today, then we will get to a point where we will be unable to distinguish between video games and reality. And so between, you know, those two individuals in particular, I think really opened up the discussion within both Silicon Valley and in academia. Now, when I wrote the book, I had been involved in a program at the MIT Game Lab, which studies video games. And of course, you know, there were people, I think, in academia were more than willing to discuss it, though they weren't necessarily, you know, willing to take a public stance on whether they thought we were in a simulation or not. I think it's more seen as this is a fun topic we can talk about, as opposed to a serious topic that physicists, you know, are willing to say this is a real possibility. In fact, you know, most physicists still believe that there's a material world, even though their own discipline is telling them that may not be the case.
Yeah. And there's a, I'm going to send it to Sinead right away. Is there a difference, I guess, depending who you're talking to? Like in academia, people always think that because you're got a PhD, you know everything about everything, and people are very specialized. So the computer people are into it, the physics people aren't. Is there any other sort of groups that are taking positions or are involved, or they really don't really care? It's not really in their sort of field.
Well, I think within philosophy, you know, people are pretty open to it. You know, within neuroscience, people are certainly open to the idea that, you know, the real world as we know it is just a set of electrical signals. If you remember from the Matrix, right, there was a quote from Morpheus, who was named after the Greek god of dreams, said, "What is real? It is a series of electrical signals into your brain." And so I think there's a group of people, you know, within academia, within neuroscience and other places, for example, Donald Hoffman at the University of California, Irvine, came out with a book called The Case Against Reality, who, you know, take the more subjective view. Now, when I talk about the simulation hypothesis, I like to make a distinction, because it turns out that one of these is easier for academics to get into than the other. And so the two versions I talk about are the NPC version and the RPG version. And so the NPC version of the simulation hypothesis is the non-player characters. So these are like the AI in the video game. So if you're, you know, playing World of Warcraft and you, you know, chop the head off an orc or a dragon, you know, those are not people playing those characters. Those are just AI characters in the simulated world. But the other version, the RPG version, which I think is actually the more interesting version, is we exist outside of the video game and we play avatars inside the video game. So now you'll notice these two are not mutually exclusive. In a game like World of Warcraft or League of Legends, you will have both. You'll have PCs, player characters, and NPCs, non-player characters, and they'll be mingling in a multiplayer game. And so, you know, within academia, the idea that we could all be NPCs has actually caught on, and people are willing to discuss it because they're seeing that the number of computations, you know, we can do with computers is rivaling the number of computations that can be done in the brain. And so, you know, many people think we're only decades away from achieving artificial general intelligence. And so who's to say we aren't AI? So that version, they're pretty open to. The RPG version, which is closer to, I think, what a lot of people in the religious traditions talk about, we exist outside of the game. That one's a little bit harder for anybody in the hard sciences or technology world to talk about, although people in the religious world are, you know, are very open to talking about that idea.
Okay, Sinead.
Thank you, Grant. Riz, first of all, I love that you're mentioning The Matrix, because I'm also a movie person. Grant is not, so you're kind of helping me prod him a little closer towards actually watching The Matrix, Grant. Which is
he hasn't seen The Matrix yet?
He's never seen it. It's just shocking. He's never seen it. So I'm going
to... Well, you know, this year, sorry to interrupt, but this year there's actually four simulation-related movies that are out. There was a documentary called A Glitch in the Matrix. There was a movie with Salma Hayek called Bliss. There's one with Ryan Reynolds called Free Guy, where he plays an NPC. And then The Matrix 4 is coming out in December. So this is the year to watch Matrix movies.
I always have the problem that I very rarely watch fiction, because I want people to know that if I tell you a story, I didn't get it from a movie. I actually experienced it or something like that. So that's my catch. But it's true, I have not watched The Matrix. I know a lot about it, but I have not watched it. So go ahead, Sinead.
Love it. You're going to absolutely love it. It's a fantastic film. But Riz, here's my question for you. So my introduction to this concept that you are an expert in, I wasn't thinking of it as being the way you're describing it right now. This is several years ago, but I had read this really interesting article about training for athletes, and how there was this new type of training methodology that was being used, where athletes were basically hooked up to some kind of machine. They wouldn't be running around a track or jumping or, you know, doing whatever they usually be doing outdoors. They would be in place on a, let's say, a treadmill indoors, connected to a computerized machine, and then they would be visualizing their training. So their trainer would be there with them. Their trainer would be telling them, okay, now you're going to be doing this, now you're going to be doing that, such as lifting weights, or you're going to run 10K or whatever it was. But they wouldn't actually be doing that. They would be moving on a treadmill, let's say, but they wouldn't actually be lifting the weights or, you know, running the 10K. So the trainer and the researchers who were there involved in this project were saying to them, you have to visualize this. And what was fascinating to me was that these were professional athletes, right? So their bodies are used to doing things a certain way, and their minds are used to thinking a certain way, because it's such a disciplined profession. But they were simply visualizing this, and the same parts of their brains were lighting up that would light up if they were actually doing the activity. And also their muscles were responding in a way that they would if they were normally doing the activity. So I thought that was fascinating. I thought, like, that is such a clear example of the overlap between mind and, you know, perception, but also there's machines, and it's not exactly reality, but it also is. So what could you say about that in terms of, you know, how the material brain and the body, the muscles respond to to, you know, entering into another kind of way of perceiving or another kind of reality, kind of what you were saying about how you drop the controller, you're trying to open this gate or something and you drop the controller, you're so convinced you were in this other place. So how, yeah, how does that play into the work that you're doing?
Yeah, well, you know, it definitely plays in because within the video game world, there have been studies done where they find that if a virtual character smiles at you, you know, you have a physiological reaction very similar to if a person were to smile at you in the physical world. And so you start to see this overlap between the reactions that we have and the types of stimuli that there might be. And so within the virtual reality world, there are companies that are started which are using VR to help you relax for meditation, or for example, or to de-stress. When I was at MIT, we had a company come through where a guy actually trained professional athletes and he would measure their stress, and they were creating these little environments in VR. So you could put it on and you could measure the amount of stress, you know, using various biofeedback measurements, et cetera. And then it turns out there's actually companies now that are using virtual reality to help people overcome anxiety and phobias. So where, you know, if you're afraid of spiders, well, or snakes, you're not going to go, you know, get an actual snake. But turns out in virtual reality, you can have a snake in there and your body reacts in a similar way. So it's possible to condition the person to get over their anxiety. And so there's a lot of studies around this that are still being done. I'd say it's a relatively new area, but it's very true. And if you've ever been inside a virtual reality game, like I was in another one where I was in a cave complex on a path with a steep fall to my right. And I didn't want to move my leg to the right because it felt like I would actually fall over, which of course I wouldn't because I was just in a virtual reality room. So, you know, I think we're learning more about how the brain works through this type of technology. And then in my book, you know, one of the stages that I talk about to get to Matrix-like video games is actually brain-computer interfaces, right? So this is a new area where you would interface the computer code and send the signals directly into your brain and read your responses right out of the brain. Now, this is still in its infancy. Elon Musk comes up again because he has a company called Neuralink where they had a monkey playing video games and they showed that he was able to control it with his mind because of that they were able to measure the signals, the electrical signals that were coming out. And so there's ways to do it using electrical signals in the brain. There's ways to measure electrical signals in the arm, et cetera. And so brain-computer interfaces is a pretty fascinating area in and of itself. And before we would really build something fully like the Matrix, we would need to have that. And of course, then the resolution is the resolution of the brain, which people have said is the best visualization device that's out there when we visualize internally. So yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap between how we visualize things and simulation theory and virtual reality. And in fact, you know, if you look back at, we were talking a little bit about Buddhism earlier, and I studied a lot about the Tibetan dream yoga. And so this was one of the six yogas of Naropa. And it was a way for people to realize that the world is an illusion by learning to do something like a lucid dream where you would wake up inside the dream. And so, you know, it occurred to me as I was laying out all these technological stages that we would get to in a few decades or a century or so, maybe, I realized we already had all of that technology. It was already in our heads. Every night when we dream, we create the simulated world. And within it, there are characters that look like independent characters. And we forget that there's a part of us outside of that dream that is actually laying in bed. So it becomes completely immersive. And we can not only react to it, but it reacts to us. And so it's interesting that technology, to a certain extent, already exists.
Wow, that is fascinating. And actually, you're kind of making me think about how Pokemon was a huge craze. I mean, not way back when, but there was I can't remember what it was called exactly.
The Pokemon Go, right? A few years ago,
Pokemon Go was the mobile game. Yes, they were holding their phones and they could actually see, you know, actually see the Pokemon character in front of them. And that changed everything for a lot of people in the autism community who had a great deal of social anxiety, who didn't feel like they could go outside and actually interact with the, you know, the so-called physical environment and human beings were out there with them. But using this game, they were able to go out and have conversations with people and be out in the world and feel comfortable and feel safe because they have this phone in their hand, right? They were operating through a virtual reality. So it's interesting to me because there's so much about, you know, technology is awful for us, it's taking away from our humanity, which I think is also true, you know, but there's lots of advantages to it as well. So you're highlighting a really incredible advantage that it can contribute to our vision of ourselves as human beings, but also our wellness as human beings, which I didn't really think about.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole wellness industry, you know, with using technology, you know, ranging from sensors, EEG sensors, et cetera. But, you know, Pokemon Go is interesting because it was one of the first successful AR or augmented reality apps. And so the idea with AR is you put a picture over the physical world and it looks like there's a little Pokemon character or an object in the physical world. Of course, with Pokemon Go, you could only see it by looking through your phone's camera. But there's a whole slew of companies that are creating augmented reality glasses. So you put on the glasses and then you actually see physical objects in the room around you. So you might say, well, what if I decorated my house with this painting on this wall? All right. So you could put on the glasses and then see the painting on the wall and see how it might look before you made a decision to, you know, actually purchase it. And so those started off as very big glasses, just like virtual reality glasses, but they're getting smaller and smaller to the point where, you know, we're going to have glasses soon. I don't know if you're a science fiction fan, so you might know Westworld, but in the latest season of Westworld, Grant would and may not know this, but they had these glasses. You would put on the glasses and then the person would appear in front of you to talk to you as if they were actually there, right? So we're actually pretty close to being able to do stuff like that. Pretty close means, you know, within X years time.
So why didn't Google Glasses work out? Because that came out a few years ago, I thought.
Yeah, that was a while ago. It was been like 8 years ago. Google Glass, I think, had the problem that many technologies have that the Apple Newton had back in the 90s, right? It was just too early. Like people weren't ready really to accept it. And also it looked like a weird thing that anybody could look at you and see that you had this weird thing popping out. Whereas, you know, the glasses are, at some point we'll get to the point where they're contact lenses. And so then, you know, you could have information being displayed, which interesting, I don't know if you've ever interviewed Whitley Strieber, but, you know, he's talked about having an implant that sends out text in his eyes. I'm pretty sure he talked about this publicly. Hopefully he has. He won't be mad at me for mentioning it, but I think he has, where he would see like little text in his eyes. And that's the kind of technology, you know, that you could see with augmented reality contact lenses, which can overlay stuff around you. So there's lots of different types of applications for the technology. But what it's doing is it's blurring the line between the physical world and the digital world. You know? Mm-hmm. And that really is very much what the simulation hypothesis is about. And so if you look within, you know, quantum physics and you ask, well, what is matter? They can't find it, right? They keep opening it up and it's like 99% space. And the electron's not really even there. It's just a set of probabilities. And so there was a physicist named John Wheeler who, he worked with Einstein and Niels Bohr and many of the fathers of quantum physics. And, you know, he said that physics went through three phases in his lifetime. In the first phase, everything was a particle. They thought everything was solid. It was an actual object. In the second phase, they thought everything was a field, like a field of probabilities. And the third phase, and he died, I think, in the 80s or 90s. I'll have to look up when he passed away. But he said he realized that everything was actually information. It was a series of yes, no questions. So the only way to really define a particle is to answer these questions. And it turns out that is pretty much what computer science is based off of, right? All of computer science and information science is based off of the bit, which is a zero or a one. So it's a yes, no question. And so Wheeler came up with this famous phrase that says it from bit, which means anything that looks like an it is actually, if you really open up those Russian dolls and try to figure out what's there, is really a series of bits of information. And so I think that's the broader theme with augmented reality as well, is that we're starting to blur the line between what is a physical object and what is a digital object based on information.
Oh, Sinead wants me to go. Okay, you're talking about Wheeler. He talked about the participatory universe. And you know the debate, because it's probably in your book, all this stuff about, is there a physical world or is it a conscious world? Like the idea where, you know, Max Planck said nothing gets behind consciousness. Wheeler says it's a participatory universe. Niels Bohr says, I've studied, and he got one in the Nobel Prize for the atom. And he said, I've studied the atom and there is no matter as such. and I speak as an authority on science. And so where do you go in your book and looking at these ideas of consciousness versus the physical world, brain versus mind, and the idea of information? What do you say information is? Like, is consciousness the information, or what is basic information that the universe is using?
Sure. Well, that's a good question, a very big question. Yeah. But yeah, I spent a lot of time looking into the implications of quantum physics. And, you know, you're talking about sort of the mind versus matter debate. And I think, you know, most scientists, to a certain extent, still like to think of the universe as being physical, right? As opposed to being, you know, whether it's a participatory universe or it's a consciousness-based universe. And so the two most popular interpretations right now are the Copenhagen interpretation, which was based on Niels Bohr, who says there's a probability wave, and when it gets observed, it collapses, you know, to a single possibility. But until then, all the possibilities exist. There are others who didn't like that idea, including Schrodinger, who came up with the idea of Schrodinger's cat. In fact, he came up with it to say, this is ridiculous. A cat can't be both alive or dead. It has to be one or the other. But it's often used as a good way to explain this weirdness in the quantum world that, in fact, quantum physics is telling us the cat is both alive and dead. It's in a state of superposition, as they call it. So that's the technical term for that state before it collapses. Now, in recent years, another theory has caught on within physicists, which is the many worlds interpretation, right? And so that says that every time there's a decision, the cat is alive or dead, we spawn off multiple worlds. So there's a universe where the cat is alive, and there's a universe where the cat is dead. And I find that like an interesting explanation as well. But if you look at both of those explanations and ask yourself, well, why does this happen? Well, we don't know, right? Physics doesn't have a good explanation. Now, going back to the first one, which the golden rule seems to be only that which is observed is actually shown, right? And turns out that's pretty similar to what we do in video games, right? So if you go back to video games from when I was a kid, like Pac-Man or Space Invaders, right? They were just 2D games with this very small number of pixels and bits. And you said back then, well, can you render something, a lush three-dimensional world like Fortnite or World of Warcraft or Second Life? The answer would be no. There are just too many pixels. There's no way we would be able to render all of that with the computing power that we have. Well, what happened in the intervening 30, 40 years was, one, computers got better so we can process more information. But more importantly, we came up with an optimization techniques, right? And so with those techniques, we basically only render that which can be seen by your avatar in the game, right? So if you and I were both you and I and Sinead were all in the same room inside a video game, I would only see the pixels rendered that my avatar could see. And if, you know, Sinead was sitting behind, say, a wall, I wouldn't be able to see her avatar, but she would see only what she can see. And so it seems to me that this quantum indeterminacy is an optimization algorithm that says everything is possible until and when it needs to be rendered, which leaves us with the big question of, okay, what is doing the rendering, right? And in fact, right now we're doing the same thing. I mean, I'm talking to both of you, but the reality is I'm not really talking to you. My voice is being translated into bits, which are being sent over the wire and are being rendered on your desktop computer. And I believe Sinead is in a different location, right? So it's being rendered on her computer. So we have three different individual devices rendering what's actually happening. What we think of as a conversation of us being in the same room really is a very subjective rendering thing. And I think this is where the simulation hypothesis overlaps with ideas of UFOs and paranormal phenomena, right? I was talking with Jacques Vallée last year, or I think the year before that, about the simulation hypothesis. And he said that in many of his sightings, there was this unexplainable element. And sometimes they left that out of like the official reports that they gave to MUFON or to the government. And he said the unexplainable part of it was that one person might see it and the person standing next to them might not. Or that the UFO actually had to go through the walls, like even though it was a physical object with physical evidence that something landed here, before it landed here, like in one case, he was in the Northern California with all these redwoods. And he said, they said it came down at a 45 degree angle. And he just kind of scratched his chin and said, well, that means it would have had to go literally through the trees. And they go, yeah, but we don't want to say that because that sounds crazy.
Yeah. Well, Valet is a guy that used to, I used to think the guy was crazy. And now I'm going like, yeah, this is, the more you look at it, the more Valet was right all along, because he never always said, you know, I'd be very suspicious if this turned out to be ETs in spacecraft. There's something else going on here. And so I'm glad you got to talk to him, because he is the, I would say, the number one person in terms of maybe understanding what's actually going on.
Yeah, and understanding how strange it is too, I guess. And he's also a computer scientist. So, you know, we were talking about how this might work. And so it turns out we do this in video games all the time. Like if we were all in the same room, but my character was level 2 and yours was level 3, but let's say Sinead was level 30, we could render something on her device that could be seen by her, but we wouldn't see it. So we would say it's not there, but she'd say, oh, it's obviously there. It's right there in front of me, right? And so you can do conditional rendering based on information. So that's, you know, one of the aspects of it. The other aspect, and this is actually the subject of my new book, which will be out in September, is if you look at the multiverse theory, well, it turns out that only makes sense if you think of it as a simulated world, because there's nothing in nature where you can clone. Like you can't clone a whole planet. You can't clone a whole tree in an instant, right? And so if the multiverse theory is true, you would be cloning the entire physical universe, not once, but every instant that there is a decision being made, like an observation. Well, it turns out information can be cloned very quickly. Physical objects take time to be constructed and rendered, et cetera, but there's usually operations in a processor which say clone all these bits very simply. Or you don't even need to clone them in some cases. You can just say go from this set of bits, just change this one bit. That's the only difference between these two. So information compression and storage and copying are like pretty fundamental ways in which we do computer science. And so, you know, this led me to think that if there are multiple universes, they are really multiple timelines, you know, within a rendered world. And, you know, another person that I interviewed for my book was the wife of Philip K. Dick, you know, the science fiction writer. And, you know, she told me that he believed, you know, not only that we were in a computer program reality, there's actually a pretty famous quote from him saying, we are living in a computer generated reality and the only clue we have is when some variable is changed, some alteration in our reality occurs. And she said it came to him when he thought he went into the bathroom and he thought there was a chain there for the light to be turned on. I think this was in the 70s or 60s. But it was a light switch. And he said, something is different here. I mean, I distinctly remember coming in this bathroom so many times and pulling the light. And so he thought there was some weird little change that was being made. And he wrote this story called The Adjustment Team, which was later made into a movie called The Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon and Emily Blunt. But it was about these guys who would come in and change things. And so over time, he began to believe this was happening not at just tiny levels, but at very big levels. Like he said, he wrote his book called The Man in the High Castle, which was a Hugo Award-winning book back in 1960 about when the Japanese and the Germans won World War II. And he said he did it not just as pure science fiction, it was from fragmentary memories of this alternate timeline. And he believed that someone had rewound the timeline and run it again. Now that sounds a lot more like a computer game and a computer simulation, you know, than a physical universe that has only one level of reality. And so it's very possible that things like the Mandela effect are actually us remembering a different run of the same timeline. So it's like you can run a simulation again and again to see what might happen. You
know? That would explain synchronicity as well, do you think? Sorry, Sinead.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Synchronicities.
Yeah, synchronicities and deja vu, right, are kind of a couple of areas which I think explain. So, I mean, he thought deja vu was literally you're feeling like you're running through the same scene again because you actually are. You've actually been through it before and you don't actually remember it. You know, I think it can explain synchronicity as well, because synchronicity seems like, you know, two things that aren't connected logically, but they are connected from the point of view of the observer, right? And so, you know, recently I was talking with Diana Walsh-Pasulka, you know, who wrote American Cosmic, and she calls it a technological singularity. And that's the idea that, like, if I'm on Facebook, and we've probably all had this happen to us where I was just shopping for something on Amazon, and I go to Facebook, and I see an ad for that same thing that I was shopping for. And you're like, wait, how did it know that I was just shopping for shoes. Why is it showing me an ad for shoes or, you know, for a trip to Italy when I was just on a completely different website? I might have been on, you know, in a completely different browser window. And turns out there's these thing called cookies, which are used and kept track of by the observer, and they're used by advertisers. So there's a technological reason why it's showing me this thing that coincides. But if I knew nothing about cookies, I'd say, wow, this is magic. How's this happening? And so, you know, getting back to Jacques Vallée, you know, Jacques believes that the universe stores information by using association. And so it's just a structure of how the universe stores that information. It doesn't store it based on A, B, C, D, E, F. It stores it based on some association. And so that's why things that are associated with each other appear at the same time, because it's actually more efficient for the universe to do it that way. So that's one possible, you know, explanation of synchronicity, I think. Yeah.
So do you feel like the virtual reality world, I mean, you've been talking about how it's blurring the line between what's real and what isn't, what's real and what's digital. It's also coming into our lives in a very personal way, in a very real way, you know, like kinesthetic sensory way in which we become completely convinced, or we can completely forget that we are not in our living room anymore, you know, where we feel like we're actually in this other place. So do you feel like VR is also, or virtual simulated reality in whatever form, is also using association to help us compute what's going on, because it's giving us familiar scenarios, right? It's using things that we already have some knowledge of, or some exposure to, or some familiarity with, or, you know, our senses have some memory of. And these are the worlds that we're choosing, or that we're being invited into, is worlds that kind of help us bridge into that, you know, what appears to be something that is so completely separate or different from our real lives, but we're actually being invited in this very particular way, right, by it using things that are familiar to us that we can recognize, that our bodies can respond to. So do you feel like, I mean, of course that makes sense, but do you think that the virtual reality world is helping us? Because a lot of people think that we're in a phase of, you know, a giant shift of global consciousness, and that many, many people all over the world are waking up to, you know, a new understanding and a new kind of self-awareness and a new understanding of what consciousness is. Do you think that this experience of gradually making our way into virtual reality worlds more and more is helping us wake up to what reality so-called actually is, or helping us gain more understanding of consciousness? Yeah.
I personally think it will help us to kind of wake up to find out what's really going on, because it gives us a model for how to think about something like higher dimensions, right? Because if you go back to the Vedas 5,000 years ago, you know, they talked about the Leela, or the grand play, and the metaphors they used were of a play or a game. And also in the Buddhist traditions, they talk about dreams as the metaphor for reality. You know, going up to Shakespeare with his all the world's a stage and the men and women are merely players on it. And so those were the analogies that they used, because that was sort of what they had. If you go back to the 20th century, you had Yogananda, who wrote the famous autobiography of a yogi, and talk about reality is like a movie. It's like a film projector. You watch the things going on in the film. You can see people dying, but that's not the reality of what's going on. That's just what it looks like is going on. And so I believe, you know, if Yogananda were alive today, he would say that life is more like an interactive video game. And so what happens is our ability to understand things is based a little bit on our ability to define metaphors, like Plato's idea of the cave, right? It was a metaphor that people could understand back then, that we were all locked inside a cave and not seeing the real world. We're seeing shadows on a wall of something like puppets, you know, going by. And so that was a metaphor. So I do believe that as we create more detailed virtual realities that are closer to physical objects, right? I mean, just the fact that we spent so much time on Zoom over the last year, right, is already sucking us into the virtual world, so that we feel like, oh, I just talked to so-and-so, but I didn't. It was actually just a virtual interaction that I just had with that person from my living room. And so, you know, the more we do that, the more I think we get used to being in the virtual world. And so I do believe it'll lead us. I mean, the simulation hypothesis is the idea that if we can get to that point, maybe it's already happened and we're already inside the virtual reality. So there are even many atheists who say, well, you know, the simulation hypothesis makes me reconsider my position, because anyone outside the simulation would seem to us like a god or gods or programmers, you know, which is sort of even Philip K. Dick, I think he was the first person to use that term. The programmer is like, you know, modifying things in our reality. So I think it gives us this ability to envision a broader perspective of what is reality. I mean, we're not quite there at Matrix levels of virtual reality yet, but we'll probably will be there, I think, within a number of decades. And so I think at that point, people will start to realize that, hey, this may be what's going on all along.
And then do you think the metaphorical red pill and blue pill will come into play at that point? And if so, what will they be? What will the red pill be and what will the blue pill be, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. Well, if we're, you know, stuck inside our simulations all the time, then, you know, it's a matter of just taking off the headset, right? But at that point, it would be beamed into us. But in terms of our physical reality, you know, I personally, you know, tend to agree with a lot of the mystical traditions that, you know, we already have this ability to wake up and realize that this isn't the physical world around us. It's like that lucid dreaming idea, that to recognize that this is in fact a dream, that something is off. And that's what a lot of these glitches, so-called glitches in the matrix, as they're called now, whether it's synchronicity or deja vu or other, you know, strange things like precognitive dreams, you know, where you realize, oh, you know, I saw this before. I saw it in a dream. Was the dream a rehearsal for what's actually happening now? So I think those things are the clues that can help wake us up. So I guess those would be the red pills, you know, in a way. And I think the blue pill is just, you know, saying, nope, there's nothing beyond this physical reality. So it's keeping the blinders on.
Yeah. Okay. So do you think it's a choice then? Do you think it's a choice, or do you think that there's some kind of outside, you know, higher, greater intelligence that's playing a game with us and we're an experiment? You know, it kind of makes me think of Douglas Adams' book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. One of my favorite things about it is the fact that he introduces this idea that mice are actually highly evolved extraterrestrial beings, and they have been sent here, or they came here deliberately to study us. So we think that mice are pests, and we think that, you know, we have to use them in labs, and we have control over them, and we can trap them, and we can kill them whenever we want to. We are dominant, they are powerless, when in the book, it's actually the other way around, right? That they are highly intelligent beings who think that we're not so bright, and they're studying us. So do you think that it's a choice to perceive one way or the other? Or do you think that there's this sort of higher intelligence or greater intelligence, or maybe a collective intelligence, that is playing a game with us?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. It's a very deep question. You know, I'm a big fan of the Hitchhiker's Guide books as well. But I think it goes back to my fundamental distinction between the NPC version and the RPG version of the simulation hypothesis. If we're an NPC version, then there, it is in fact a higher intelligence just sitting there watching the screen saying, okay, what are these crazy AIs going to do, right? In the RPG version, we exist outside of the simulation, right? So we are characters in the game, but we are the ones who are outside the simulation as well. So, you know, one of the questions I ask people is, well, why would we set up a simulation? I say, well, why do you play video games? Right. Well, we do to have experiences that we can't have outside of the video game. Right. I can't jump on a dragon and fly around and slay orcs and do all this cool stuff, or go on maybe some of us can go on ET spaceships, but it's a lot easier in a video game to do that. So we do it to have experiences that we can't have. And so within the RPG version, there's also this distinction that I like to make between the single player version and the multiplayer version. And the single player version is, you know, closer to the philosophical idea of idealism, where there's no reality. The only thing I can be sure of, you know, going back to Descartes, you know, 500 years ago, is that I think, therefore I am, right? There could be an evil demon deceiving me and everything else is not real, but I know I'm real. But the MMORPG version is actually more interesting. So today when we play video games online, you can have millions of people logged on, right? In Fortnite, there were like 12 million people watching this one concert, right? Which was like a virtual concert. So it was 12 million avatars standing in this virtual space watching an actual singer sing, but the singer was then, you know, his voice was actual, but portrayed as an avatar within the Fortnite world. So within an MMORPG, we are all making decisions individually about what's happening. And so that's why I like to make this distinction with a rendering device. We are all rendering reality on our own laptops or our own phones or our own X, whatever X happens to be in that case, because it depends what we, you know, what we are outside. So if we're just consciousness outside the simulation, then really it's being rendered onto that consciousness in some way. If there's a physical world outside of the simulation, then it's probably a more physical device. But I believe that we are all having a subjective experience, and somehow it's all being choreographed, just like with this call. It's all being choreographed to make it look like we're all in the same room or we're all talking to each other. But the reality is we're not, and there could be little differences of things that are happening along the way.
That's another aspect that also intrigues me, you know, the idea of like how creation, how creativity and creation come into this, because there's so many different ways of talking about that. It, you know, there's a common example that we talk about how we create our own reality, right? Like the way we wake up in the morning, the whatever we decide to think that day or whatever attitude we decide to approach that day with, that's a large part of how we're going to determine how that day will unfold for us, right? So if we wake up in a miserable mood and we're cranky and we're terrible to people, most likely we're going to have a cranky, terrible day. But if we wake up and say, no, today's going to be a good day and confront it that way, then you end up having a different day, right? So of course, everyone understands that idea. Attitude is everything. We create our own kind of experience. And then expanding that even more, we create our own reality. But I'm fascinated with the idea, and Grant and I have talked about this a lot as well. You know, is if this is a simulated reality, if this is not, if this is all an illusion, which I personally think that it is in some form, then is it just me? Am I the consciousness and I'm creating all of this for myself, that somehow I am, you know, you don't actually exist except in my mind, and Grant doesn't exist except in my mind? Or is this a collective experience where we're collectively creating together? And if so, how is that occurring? So, you know, in virtual reality, just as you were just saying, people are choosing to come together in certain spaces and co-create not only whatever the virtual reality environment is, but co-create the experience of being in that reality. And it's just as holistic as it would be if it was, you know, physical. So what can you say about that? What do you think of that idea? You know, is it one consciousness that is creating everything and perceiving everything, or do you think it's collective? What's your perspective on that?
Well, you know, my perspective is that's closer to the MMORPG, so the massively multiplayer online role-playing game, which is that in fact we have multiple consciousness and we are all playing the game together. But if you think of it in terms of a video game, you know, I might choose a character, or let's go back to the days before video games. I used to play Dungeons and Dragons, you know, back in the 80s, and you have a character sheet and you say, you know, I'm going to be a barbarian and I'm going to have a lot of strength, but not so much intelligence. And I'm going to have, you know, somebody else is really stealthy and they have a lot of charisma. Well, it turns out we all have different attributes on our avatars within this game, right? We can choose to develop certain ones, I think, better than others, but I feel like we all come in with a set of attributes and a set of tasks and quests, which are things that we are meant to do. And so I think of that as our storyline. And so within video games, we always have quests and achievements as a way of breaking down, you know, what that character should be working on next. And so, you know, that's how you make progress and you level up in the game, is you achieve a particular quest and then you go on to the next quest, which might be more difficult as well. So I believe a part of, when we talk about creating our own reality, that part of it we've already mapped out for ourselves a broad storyline. You know, I mean, who's to say that, you know, Grant was going to be researching paranormal phenomenon when he was a baby, right? or that I was going to be interested in simulation and its overlap with religion. But I believe that we all have things that draw us, and it's partly built into our character storyline, and we can always make our choices to not follow a particular path or not go with a particular person. And, you know, I believe it's related to the idea of karma, where karma can be thought of, you know, within the Hindu and Buddhist traditions, there's actually two slight variations. Within the Hindu tradition, there's an indestructible soul that goes back and inhabits each body. Now, of course, you don't have to make much of an analogy with video games. You go in, you have a body, you download the information, and at the end of the life, you upload the information. Where does it go? To some cloud server is what I like to call it. And in Buddhism, there's not necessarily a soul, but rather a bag of karma, which, what is that? That's just information, right? So now we're back to information. It's just something in a database somewhere that we can keep track of. And by when we change our thoughts, or as you said, create a reality or act act idiotic towards people or mean towards people, I feel like it adds little tasks into the database that says, okay, this is stuff that we're going to have to deal with. And so, you know, it may not be always that easy to change things because we have a whole bunch of this stuff from the past that we still have to figure, you know, we still have to do. And so we have to get our list of tasks and achievements down. So, you know, that tends to be, you know, my understanding. Now, beyond that, you know, there's probably a sense of a single consciousness beyond that level of consciousness. So now we're getting into nested simulations. And where does it end? Probably it ends with a single consciousness that decided, for the same reason that we decide to create video games or movies, it's to have certain experiences by breaking out into different individual units who then decide to go in and have experiences with each other and play different roles, you know, within it. So that's sort of my thinking on the subject within the simulation.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I don't want to hog the conversation anymore. I'm just so curious, but Grant, please take it away.
I've got an important question here. You were talking about the cloud. You were talking about the Eastern religions. We always sort of assumed that the Eastern religions were kind of stupid because they couldn't build a cell phone. And then we now suddenly discover that they probably had it all figured out. They were talking about this stuff like 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. I'm very interested in your cloud analogy, the idea of information. Let me give you a couple of examples here. You mentioned Diane Pasulka. If you've read the book, you'll know there's this Tyler D guy. I actually met the guy. And he said to me, he said he had this invention that he sold, I think, for $100 million on NASDAQ, the company. He said to me, he said, you know, Grant, the morning I woke up with that idea in my head, the last thing I remember the night before was a hooded figure standing at the end of the bed. And he talks about this modality that he uses. He gets a glass of water. He sleeps for 8 hours. He gets up. He goes back to bed for an hour. He sits in the sun. He goes through that whole modality. And another example would be Larry Page. When he gave his commencement speech at Michigan, he's talking about how Google started. He said, you know, some people have dreams. I had one of those dreams. And he starts telling about this dream in the middle of the night to download the internet and just keep the links. And then there's a guy by the name of George Flynn. So they asked George Flynn, he's an autistic savant, which are very interesting people. They said, George, what's 2 + 3? And he said, would that be 7? And they said, no, it's not 7. And then they say, so what day is July the 11th, 93,430? And he says, well, that's a Tuesday. And the question starts to be is there a cloud? Because 40% of all experiencers, I know in near-death experiences, there's the same sort of thing that a lot of people in near-death experiences in the UFO community, experiencers will say, 40% of them will say, at one point during my experience, I knew the answer to everything in the universe. And when they came back, it was all gone. Now you say, well, if you're going to make up a story, that's not what you're going to make up. And you talked about this, what I call contact modalities. You talked about drumming. Can you talk about your personal experience in terms of being able to sort of get in the field? Do you think this is possible where you can sort of tap in the field through different modalities and pick up stuff like Larry Page did, or even the Stanford University? Stanford University is actually called the Leland Stanford Junior University. And it was started because Leland Stanford had a dream where his kid died at 15 years old and came back and told him he had to do something for the kids in California. That's where Stanford University comes from. And they don't want to tell that story because it's so really bizarre, or the fact that his brother was doing seances in Australia and donated £135,000 to Stanford University in 1915 for parapsychology research. And of course, because parapsychology is all nonsense, the psychology department took it. So there's all these examples. I remember you talking about the drumming. So can you talk about your personal experience in terms of being able to sort of zone out, or is there a field of information where you can download stuff and the information is there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't know that story about Stanford. I mean, I went to business school at Stanford, and they talk about Leland Stanford's son dying, and that's why they decided to establish the university. But I didn't know about the dream part. So that's quite intriguing. There was when I was at MIT, we were at the media lab, and I actually was having people try different, you know, relaxation techniques. And we actually did some shamanic drumming, some shamanic journeying, you know, within the media lab as a way for people to get access, you know, to higher creativity. And so, you know, I've experimented with a lot of different techniques, whether it's just, you know, straight meditation or shamanic journeying, which I think of as, you know, kind of, you started off as a guided meditation and it takes on a life of its own, right? And so it's a way of using the imagination. But yeah, I do believe that by getting ourselves into alignment with rhythmic breathing, and that's what really the drumming does, right? It's a certain beat. And so it allows your whole body and your breathing to slow down and get into a certain rhythm that we can kind of remember or see past all the stuff that's going on, you know, around us. It's almost as if all the stuff in our lives, there's a gentleman named Tom Campbell, you know, who wrote a book called My Big Toe, My Big Theory of Everything. And he's a big advocate of simulation theory going back many years now. And he was also at the Monroe Institute years ago. And he talks about, well, if the world is just a stream of data that's coming in, right? And so if you think about it, if all the information around me is a stream of data, and I start to just treat that data really seriously, I'm forgetting about all the other data that's out there. So, you know, by slowing down, you're almost like taking off the headset a little bit, right? You're kind of lifting it up a little bit. And of course, most of us, I think, can, you know, only access it in a sporadic way, like Tyler D seems to have a methodology, you know, for doing that. But in the Chinese traditions, there's this idea of the goddess of forgetfulness, Meng Po, and she brews the tea of forgetfulness. And we take it, you know, when we're born and then after we die so that we forget about things. And in the Greek traditions, we cross Lethe, the river of forgetfulness. And so we forget about all that stuff that was already there. And so, you know, it's fascinating to me that the Greeks had this idea that all of this information was already available to us and that we tap into it. And so, you know, I like to think of it kind of like guides in a game. You have super users and guild leaders who are like doling out tasks to people. And so maybe this hooded figure is like Tyler D's, kind of a TA, if you will, in whatever higher university in the sky, who is sending the information and saying, okay, this is your next task. This is your next task, right? This is the thing that you need to work on next. And, you know, I often feel that way with my books or with my companies or projects where, okay, it's like, well, I guess it's time that I got to do this, because this is the project that was assigned to me. And so some of it might come through relaxation, drumming, visualization, but other times it just crops up through synchronicity in the world. And usually, you know, for example, I mentioned Yogananda earlier, who wrote Autobiography of a Yogi. I'm actually writing a book for HarperCollins India about what I learned from Autobiography of a Yogi. And one day HarperCollins in India just emailed me and say, hey, we'd like you to write this book. I said, well, that's interesting. How did you end up with me? It was almost like the universe is saying, whoop, this task was assigned to you. And it wasn't like a logical thing. It's not like I've written books on Yogananda before. It was just, you're the right guy. So we want you to do it.
That's definitely very interesting. I mean, you know, I think Grant would probably second this. I'm sure that we've done so many interviews. I've been assisting him for just over a year now, a year and a few months. We've done a ton of interviews, and one of the consistent threads, you know, regardless of the context of that person's story or their background or whatever it is that they're talking about, is this feeling that, you know, there's a shared experience underneath all of this, and that we can tap into it, right, in different ways, but that we have to be able to follow the signs, the messages, instincts, whatever it is. So if you do that, you know, this is what I hear again and again, and I've experienced this myself as well, that if you do that, if you listen, you pay attention, you follow these things, even if it seems bananas or seems, you know, just like Neo was doing in The Matrix, right? He followed the white rabbit, didn't know why, didn't know where he was going, but he did it. And that's what led him further down the rabbit hole, so-called, into the truth of what was actually going on. And, you know, I hear that again and again, that people say that if they follow so-called the white rabbit, let's just call it that, that, you know, they're able to go further and further into the truth of what it is that they're trying to uncover, even if they don't exactly know what it is, because it's as if the universe is saying, oh, would you like some more? Here's a little more. Here's another breadcrumb, right? So that's what your story just now made me think of, that the universe is kind of saying, oh, you'd like some more? Here's a book. Write this book. You know, you can put your information out a little further and share it with more people and, you know, journey further into your own thinking about it. So it's really amazing how this continues to unfold. You know, we just have to have some curiosity and some open-mindedness and some willingness, and it kind of lands in our laps sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, I like to call those clues on our personal treasure hunt, right? And the idea is, like with an Indiana Jones movie, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, he doesn't just get the ark right at the beginning of the movie. He has to follow one clue, and where does it lead to the next clue? And where does that lead to the next clue? And, you know, and I think this relates to the idea of simulation in an interesting way, particularly, you know, my new book, Simulated Multiverse, is about this idea that there are actually multiple possible futures. And so it's possible that, you know, we've gone down this road before, and now we're told, don't go that way, go that way, right? This will lead to a better outcome. And
like, you know, a choose your own adventure book or something.
Choose your own adventure book, right? That there are these pathways that are, have been laid out for us, just like in a choose your own adventure book. And we can go down one and then realize it's not the right one. And we can come back and then we can go again, just like Philip K. Dick saying, you know, Germany and Japan winning World War II is not such a good idea. Maybe it doesn't lead us to the right place. And then you rewind that you can do that on a personal level as well. You know, in fact, he believed he communicated with some beings that said they tried to prevent the JFK assassination in Dallas, but then he would get assassinated in another city like Orlando or another city. And each time it would lead to a worse outcome than the one that we have. And therefore, they decided to just rewind and let it proceed. And I think that, you know, that's how, you know, quantum computers work. That's how AI training works, right, for cars. And when AI plays video games like Go and chess, you know, AI got to the point where they could beat a professional player of the game Go, which has been really difficult to do. And the way that the game learns is it plays itself like a million times, and it just learns the best strategies. And so I believe these clues could be signals that we're playing the game forward, and we're then trying different things and then picking the one, you know, so the clues are in a way a message from a possible future self. Right, which ties to the whole idea of quantum physics, which says that, you know, there may be these other different universes and possibilities, and that one of them, we only see one of them at a time, but the others exist and they're sending us information back, you know. So I think, yeah, we do have these clues, these breadcrumbs, as you call them, and as we follow them, then the universe leads us to whatever it is that we wanted to experience as part of our storyline.
Yeah, I mean, earlier when you were saying, we have to wrap up, unfortunately, but earlier when you were talking about how virtual reality is helping us, and I say helping us blur the line, not blurring the line, because usually when you say a line is blurred, it's almost a detrimental thing. It's not such a good thing. But in this case, it feels like it's a helpful thing, you know, that we're learning to expand our perception and not be so attached to the physicality of what's around us. And when you said that the line is being blurred between what's real and what isn't, I felt like in that moment when you said that, I had this feeling of, you know, a door is being knocked on, right? That this is like a knock on the door to us, to open the door, to reveal something new, to go a little further into something else that even if we don't know what it is, right? We don't know where we're going or what we're doing. Just like Neo in The White Rabbit, you still want to kind of follow it because there's something in you, maybe some ancient part of all of us, you know, maybe the part of us that's always connected to what people call source. The part of us that knows all, right? This is what some people say, that there's a part of all of us that knows all, that maybe it's that part of us, you know, that's saying, come a little further, come and get to know yourself again, go a little further down this road so that you can become more familiar with, you know, what our true nature really is. There are so many fun possibilities to explore and so many wonderful things to contemplate. So as we wrap up now, unfortunately, because this has been a wonderful conversation, what is something that you would like to leave our audience with, you know, with all the work that you're doing and all the amazing different pathways, all the choose your own adventures that you can go down with the work that you're doing? What is something that you feel is really key, really core, that you'd like to inspire our audience with by leaving it with them as a kind of golden nugget at the end of this conversation? No pressure.
Sure. Well, one of the things that jumping into simulation theory has helped me think about is that, you know, we all go through difficulties in our lives, right? And sometimes people say, well, of course, this isn't a simulated game, because if I were to make a game, I would make myself a billionaire and I would have all of these things and everything would be so great. But if you remember in the Matrix movies, in the second one or the third one, they revealed the first version of the Matrix was a blissful environment and humans didn't accept it as real because there was no conflict, there was no struggle. And so, you know, I guess the thing that I'd want to leave the audience with is that a video game is boring if there aren't any challenges or any struggles. And so the challenges are placed before you that your character is ready to accept. And part of leveling up really is dealing with those challenges. And so I think that gives us a better perspective to deal with some of the challenges we might have in life.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Grant, what about you?
I'm very honored to have done the interview. And I think you're leading the way in terms of changing consciousness I'm very optimistic after I hear you speak that, you know, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, you see a lot of strife in the world and you pointed out that may be part of what we've chosen to do. So I just acknowledge your work and we'll continue to promote your ideas as much as possible. And thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you very much for that. And thanks for having me on the podcast. This was a lot of fun.
It was great. It was great. And maybe it will happen again. Who knows? It feels like there's a to be continued somewhere in here. So thank you so much, Rizwan, for being here. Grant, thank you as always for letting me be here. And it's been such a pleasure. So good night, everybody. Good night.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.